Could you build a business that's better for our planet? That's what I have set out to answer. Hi, I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert and entrepreneur and host of the podcast, Someone Like You. I become fascinated in finding creative climate solutions in business. And on the podcast, I break down how founders and CEOs are building climate-friendly business solutions that are opportunities for growth while being better for the planet. Food sustainability is a critical issue in our society. So is there a way to sustainably build a business that combats this issue? Corin Hebert, bestselling author, co-founder of multiple businesses, and host of the podcast Aisle 42, explores this principle of sustainability in the food sector on a daily basis. As VP of Strategic Partnerships for the Ethical Food Group in Vancouver, Corin helps brands establish themselves as changemakers in the food sector. This conversation is a bit of a goldmine for anyone in or wanting to get into the food industry. In this conversation, we explore the nuance of how sustainability can be a really complex problem, but with really simple solutions. Is it too early for entrepreneurs entering the food space? We talk about Oreo versus the rest of the group. What is the unique thing about founders taken from his business and podcast success? We also talk about this marketing opportunity where younger consumers are really becoming very loyal to brands that they trust. Get ready to dive into the mind of a food industry expert.
The challenge there is that because it looks like a big, scary system and a big machine, that one person or one player, even a few, you know, can they really make an impact? One of the reasons why I get excited about the work that I do is that all of that complication goes away as soon as consumers want it. Consumer demand drives so much. I know that a lot of people think that government or policy needs to change things. Okay, that's true. But when consumers speak out, when consumers buy one brand over another because it aligns with their values or it aligns with their pocketbook or it aligns with whatever it is that they're going for, it has unbelievable force in the marketplace.
Corin, welcome to the Someone Like You podcast. I'm very excited to have you on the show. There's lots to discuss, mostly because your depth and knowledge and experience in this space. You also have a podcast, Aisle 42, so you get to also interview some amazing founders in the food space and how they're tackling sustainability. So welcome.
Marco, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So would we kind of start thinking about climate and sustainability and purpose and driving business growth? I often think about like what led you there. And I kind of wanted to start there in terms of your career. Were you in the climate space before or sustainability? How did you make your way to Ethical Food Group and all the work that you've done in this space?
Oh, I'm an accidental activist. I stumbled into sustainability, and it is a place that I will never leave. It has gotten into my bones, and it's changed me as a person. So to take a step back, I came into the agency world, the creative agency world, did a lot of work on my own, had my own agency for the longest time, and actually worked exclusively with creative entrepreneurs, creative freelancers, for the most part, artists that worked on demand. So I represented like an agent or a rep. I would work with and support creative talent that had their own studios, whether it was they were making art, or they were making education material, or they were in studios or in galleries or writing projects. I represented them if they had about $1 million or more in revenue. Instead of them continuing to build their own internal teams, I would work with them to scale out their business and handle all things operational. I sort of acted like a COO for a bunch of artists. Did that for about 16 years, and I loved it. I really, really did. But I got to a point where personally, I really wanted to, I know this sounds weird. As an entrepreneur, it sounds weird to say it, but I wanted to work in a team environment. I wanted to sort of do my best work and focus just on what I really love to do. And that's business development and client experience. And as you know, as an entrepreneur, there's times where you can do that, but there's also times where you're doing a lot of other stuff. And so I felt like I needed to change it up. I knew the agency world fairly well, but sort of from the outside looking in. So I approached a friend, and so I actually a past client who I'd done some work with was representing him and he had an agency. And so I felt like, you know, I think I can help. I think I can come into the agency world. I can do business development. I can build relationships with clients. And they had a specialty in food and beverage. It wasn't exclusive to their portfolio, but it was a lot of what they did. So I kind of got into the agency world. I surrounded myself with creatives, you know, even more than I had in the past. And I really fell in love with the environment. And after about 3 years, it was the food space that really got me excited. And it was for two reasons. One was selfish. I grew up in kitchens. I grew up cooking. I've always had a passion for cooking. It's probably my hobby. It's the thing when I want to de-stress, when I want to have fun, I make dinner. That's what I do. Or I go grocery shopping. That's what I do to have fun. That's my idea of a good time. So food has always been important to me. And then as I started to look at the food space and I started to get excited about brands and about founders and about food producers that were really going the extra mile. And as I saw how that translated to things like flavor and taste and performance and ingredients that I was excited to talk about, I started to see this common thread that they were the people, they were the brands that gave a damn, that they wanted to do something for their community, for the people around them, and for their planet. And so that's when I transitioned to Ethical Food Group. And it is a joint venture between ZGM, Zero Gravity Marketing out of Alberta, and then PS & Co. Brand Studio here in Vancouver. And this joint venture, they're putting together a small venture fund and they wanted to support the food industry in an agency and a consulting framework. And I'm just like, that's my jam. So I kind of really fell into it. I've been in this role for about a year and a half now and backed by about 170 staff across the country. And it's, you know what? It's just fun. So to answer your question more directly, I got into it because I love food and I love sustainability and I like to have fun in my work. And that's where I'm at right now.
It's a funny, interesting intersection between like just loving food and the food that you connect with. It just tends to be good food, grown well, produced well. And it seems like a lot of those kind of entrepreneurs building in that kind of space have that type of alignment. And a lot of it's kind of like how we used to eat food. So the food sector, we've covered it quite a lot around food waste. It's a massive problem. We've talked about just kind of business opportunities, how we grow food in Canada and in the United States between like importing versus exporting. Like it seems like such just a massive mix of a bunch of problems. So like, do you guys pinpoint on certain areas or like, what's your thoughts just like big picture on this issue of food and we need to feed, you know, whatever's going to be like 9 or 10 billion people into the future. So like, it just seems like such an astronomical problem, opportunity. It's such an intertwined and weird space, but also just incredible because you get all this passion too, because food is for a lot of people kind of where the heart is, where the family gets together and all these different kind of things, how you stay healthy. So like it is such a wonderful space, but it is big and convoluted.
It really is. And when you look at the carbon impact, for example, you know, the number varies, but let's just call it about 25% of the world's carbon is produced as a result of the food supply chain, from growing to manufacturing to logistics to food waste and everything in between. And the challenge there is that because it looks like a big, scary system and a big machine that one person or one player, even a few, you know, can they really make an impact? One of the reasons why I get excited about the work that I do is that all of that complication goes away as soon as consumers want it. Consumer demand drives so much. I know that a lot of people think that government or policy needs to change things. Okay, that's true. Let's look at plastic bags. You know, the governments are stepping in saying, hey, we got to kill this whole plastic bag thing. We got to deal with that. That's helpful. That's a good piece of the puzzle. And consumers were not demanding that we stop using plastic bags. So everyone has their role to play. But when consumers speak out, when consumers buy one brand over another because it aligns with their values or it aligns with their pocketbook or aligns with whatever it is that they're going for, it has unbelievable force in the marketplace. So I know a lot of people like to talk about food prices. And of course, we're dealing with pretty significant price increases over the last 3 years in the grocery store. But the reality is that people are still spending significant money on food. And when they choose food that aligns with what they believe, a great example of that is fair trade. So fair living wages for workers that produce these products and grow this some of the food that we buy. These things affect how we think about the world. They make us, when we buy food that we know is from an exploitative brand, we feel it. We do. We might not feel it all the time, but every now and then when you go buy your giant box of Oreo cookies from Costco for $7, I'd say the average person thinks to themselves, okay, this is a decadent treat. This is, you know, a luxury, if you want to call it. And it's a cheap luxury. But I think increasingly, especially those that are younger and kind of growing up in this modern era, they're thinking about the fact that this food stuff is made with the worst ingredients and they are chemically engineered to make me happy. And it's very short-lived. And I think that as consumers start to make choices well beyond that quick hit of sugar or whatever it is, that the power that they have as consumers is very compelling. And so I get excited about the consumer side of the equation. It's why I'm in the business that I'm in, is I think that there's a lot to be done there. And I think that from a sustainability standpoint, as players come into the equation where they align with values and they make things that taste good and that everyone loves, it can be a really beautiful thing. So yes, it's small moves make for big change. And I think examples of like B Corp certifications is probably one of the most notable ones, even though it's, you know, slow and growing. Transparency and trust building with consumers is the arena that I think a lot of us in the marketplace have to focus on, because that's where the battle needs to be won first.
If we can dive into the entrepreneurs, that's really fascinating because you get to work and interact with them both on your podcast as well as at Ethical Food Group. You know, a lot of people are still kind of sitting on the sideline and wondering where their career is going to take them, because I think a lot of people look at the bigger players and the bigger food producers and think, well, they just need to clean up the way that they produce. And then, you know, you look at some of the smaller ones and say, well, that's just a really, really expensive products and there's not crazy consumer demand yet. And there seems like at some point, you know, the small ones will go to the big ones will start changing it based all on consumers' demand. But is this still like really early for entrepreneurs in this space? And is it still like a tons of opportunities to disrupt? Do you think that the bigger players are still sitting around thinking like, how is this all going to play out? How's that part for these entrepreneurs that are just starting or thinking or have an idea in this space?
That's a good zip folder question, Marco. Very good. So first off, and I'll say this, you know, from the planet's perspective, one of the big challenges is that we are not seeing a lot of innovation that is replacing the bad apples. Like, there's not less Oreo cookies being sold. There's only more. So you might have 300 alternative cookies that maybe have better ingredients or a better, healthier supply chain or that blah, 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 sustainability in the mix, but they're not taking market share from said Oreo cookie. So from a big player perspective, there is not a notable threat right now. For many of the categories in the grocery store, the big players that fill those shelves, very few of them are worried about their overall market share based on innovation at the sustainability level. Now, some of those smaller brands that are rising quickly, that look exciting, that have good margins, they make for nice acquisitions and they may retain them. You know, the larger brands may retain the smaller brands, but right now we're sort of adding more to the system. Now, to your entrepreneur question, there is room to add products if you can stay away from the sort of the Me Too scenario where it's just a slight iteration or a slight zag or a little bit smarter marketing or a little bit of social impact, dare I say it, a little bit of philanthropy sprinkled over top of it. You know, that's not likely going to, well, it's not going to help the planet much or necessarily many communities. And consumers probably at the volume that we need them to really take notice anyway. So they're not really solving a problem. They're not solving a problem for the grocery store, for the category buyers that make the decisions of which product goes on shelf. And they're not necessarily solving a problem for the consumer. So the opportunities that I get really excited about, and I do feel like are going to move the needle, is sort of at that point where the innovation, it can actually change the supply chain, can actually bring the supply chain to a point where it's moving things better. I was just talking, you speak of the podcast, Aisle 42 podcast, spoke with Jenny from Equifruit, and they import fair trade certified organic bananas into Canada. And a lot of people are not accustomed to spending, you know, 30% more on their bananas, but that 30% price increase, so we're saying instead of spending $3 on bananas, you spend $4 or whatever, that small price increase means that living wages are being provided for banana farmers. in many places in Central and South America. So when, as an innovation, if you can bring something to the table as an entrepreneur that really captures the attention of consumers, that really has an impact on a supply chain that I think the banana supply chain hasn't changed in 100 years. It's very static. There's a lot of big players doing, you know, big player things. I think it's a really exciting opportunity, but the difference is, are you really leaning into the hard areas and are you doing it smartly and quickly? And I think a lot of food entrepreneurs kind of limp into it, A, because they can, B, because they feel like their friends love their hot sauce that is their grandmother's recipe. If I hear another pitch about hot sauce or barbecue sauce, I'm going to blow my brains out. Anyway, a lot of entrepreneurs make food stuff because they can, not because there's an identified need in the market and not because enough consumers are ready for an innovation. So when innovation comes into play and it goes into a sleepy category that hasn't seen much change and there can be real innovation, you know, whether it's a supply chain thing, whether I was talking to Adam from Scout Cannery and they're talking about like working with actual fishing families or Skipper Auto and Organic Ocean. These are brands that work with families that have boats that catch fish on lines and they bring the fish in and they process it in a clean, safe environment where everything's traceable and there's accountability. Those are some of the things that really move the needle. So that's a long answer to a relatively short question, but it's because it's from the business perspective. If you know that there's a need out there that you can meet, then do it well and launch well. Don't limp into it and just hope that you will slowly get there. You have to kind of play the big boy game a little bit.
I just was actually reading an article from the New York Times that got published, I think, just this past week around like the true food costs and the hidden costs behind our food. And I think there's a bunch of examples, but the big, hairy, main one was like a pound of beef is like $5.30 in the United States. And this is like based on true cost accounting is like $27. It's almost another $22 worth of estimated environmental costs to the actual cost of that good. And it's like, okay, well, that goes back to your banana scenario. Right? Where of course it costs more money because they're applying the things that we need to kind of apply to it. And often it seems that a lot of this innovation all comes around at a cost side of things. And you said something interesting earlier too before is that the consumer, it just needs to kind of meet them at the table. And if the product's really, really great and it kind of hopefully costs somewhat similar or maybe a little bit more, they're happy to do that. But we wanted to ask you around entrepreneurships again and like entrepreneurs, when you think about climate, sustainability, there's a whole thing. We're dealing with food waste versus how food is produced versus how food is processed, or completely new categories like, making salmon in an old brewery. Like, what's your feeling and thoughts just in that kind of innovation space right now? Where are there industries right now that you feel like are being over or under invested and opportunities exist where people aren't looking at?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like maybe it's the West Coast guy in me, but I feel like the seafood industry is ready for some real innovation and some real investment. I think given the tragedy that is fish farming and some of the practices that go into bringing seafood to market is pretty tragic. There's an article in the Globe and Mail about sort of a mobile fish farm. So it's big container ship was converted into a fish farm and it kind of travels around northwest of Norway out in the open water and they're trying to do things better, trying to keep these fish in fresh moving water instead of stale coastal waters. And, you know, I don't know if that's the answer, but I think that we need to be able to lean into areas where larger investments will have a much bigger impact down the road. And right now there feels like a lot of really short-term plays. So I am watching the seafood industry very carefully. I mean, the ocean can only provide this amount of seafood for so long. We need to be so careful. It needs to be very well managed. And I don't feel like on a global scale, it's well managed. So that one's got my attention. So any brands that are leaning into seafood, I think they have some unique challenges. And I think that the opportunity is pretty important. Given that there's right now, more so than I think in the recent past, protein has gotten really high on people's radar right now. Though when I interviewed Miyoko Shinner, she said, you know, that we have a bit of a protein crisis here, that we're all so geared to want protein that has a doctor ever said to us out loud, you have a protein deficiency? I don't think anyone's ever been told that. So we've come to rely heavily on protein. And so I think that as we start to look at some of these protein protein-based markets, and seafood being one of them. How can we steward that better? And as consumers, how can we focus on buying the seafood that, yes, we want it for its protein, but we obviously want it for its taste and its texture and it's the things that it brings to the recipes we love. I think we need to buy it in such a way that we're really proud of it. And, you know, that's one of the filters I like to put on it. It's one of the consumer filters I like to kind of explore sometimes is that, you know, how often do we make something that we're really proud of, whether it's a lunch or a dinner or whatever it is? If we're proud to serve something, that says a lot about who we are. It says a lot about the gift that we want to give someone that we're feeding. And so, you know, if for those of us that are responsible for feeding our families, you set some food down on the table and, you know, you want to feel that sense of, in fact, to that note, I rarely set food on our table. I've done this for years and I think that sometimes maybe I shouldn't, but I always plate our food. When I serve my family or extended family, I often am plating the food, and maybe it's the restaurant guy in me, but I love serving things that I'm proud of. And so when I know that I've got, you know, wild caught salmon that was smoked by an indigenous community in the north coast of British Columbia, and I know that this purchase has made an impact on that family or those families that work in that community, that means something to me. And of course, I want it to taste good. Of course, it needs to be a great product. But when there's something more behind it, I think that level of pride can be really, really special. And you start adding layers of transparency and a support network where you kind of feel like the world is a little better as a result of buying and consuming a product like that. I think it's a beautiful thing. So, you know, when we talk about entrepreneurs leaning into the space, the food space that they want to, do something remarkable. Like don't just limp in. Do something that really is very special and that it's worthy of a deep conversation. And when I see people, Mark from Sysgrainable is a good example where he's taking expired barley and he's drying it, grinding it up, turning it into a flour additive and adding fiber, serious fiber into baking mixes. Well, we have a fiber crisis. Our health problems often can be traced back to a lack of fiber. And so when I hear about an upcycled initiative like that, that puts more fiber, healthy fiber into a system, and it's reducing the amount of waste going into the landfill, that's a beautiful thing. And that is worth talking about. So it's a filter I like to have. Like, is this worth talking about? Is this something I'm proud of? And that can go right down to business as well.
I wanted to take a second to tell you about our season 2 sponsor, Springwise. Springwise is the global ESG innovation platform that offers its readers early access to the ideas transforming our world. I actually started using Springwise probably 10 years ago to review innovative startup ideas, and I've been a fan ever since. There are 3 new stories on the site every weekday featuring solutions to some of the biggest challenges we face as a global community. You'll find innovations in climate tech, renewable energy, plastic alternatives, the circular economy, and how we can live a more sustainable life. The stories are sourced and written by the Springwise team of journalists and will give you an inspiring take on what's right around the corner, whether you read it to inform your work or simply for a regular dose of optimism. Springwise sets the innovation agenda. The newsletter is free to access, and to sign up, visit springwise.com/newsletter-signup. Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it. And also, don't forget, subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. Asking about this Oreo scenario because I can't get it off my mind.
I don't know why I brought up Oreos. I've never talked about Oreos before in my life.
Well, it's a great example. And, you know, I've had my share of Oreos growing up in the 80s and 90s. And so I've luckily kept my kids away from it. But thinking about that statement of Oreos or kind of another conglomerate in some of those spaces, you know, like, you know, potato chips or, you know, whatever the big brands are, that consumers are still consuming that. They're still owning it. I listened to a podcast on Olipop recently, which is similar. You're talking about fiber. They try to inject fiber into their products, but just like how small they still are comparatively to Coca-Cola and Pepsi. They did just win this small win against them, I guess, this new stadium in LA. I guess every stadium typically has an exclusive with Coca-Cola or Pepsi or what other one, and they can't have any other pop. And Olipop got the ability to be licensed in that too, which is like a really interesting move. But like, how does that change? Like, how do you have 300 cookie replacements take on somebody like an Oreo? What does that actually even potentially look like when we think about all those impacts between how they're processed, ultra processed foods, to sustainably grown, to, you know, thinking about climate change, like all that aspect, that's big. Obviously, it is quite daunting. But are there examples of that that you kind of look at?
Yeah. You know, I feel like there are brands that, at least in the Canadian landscape, that are starting to really get some really interesting attention. And even though this, I might be jumping the shark a little bit right now, but there's a brand out on the East Coast called Made with Local. And it's a brand that when it started was very, ingredient supply chain was very centered, you know, geographically, like these are ingredients that are grown or produced locally, and we're going to assemble them and make something that we're really proud of. In fact, early on, they used social enterprise kitchens to manufacture these snack bars. And now that their business is getting bigger, it's sort of changing a little bit, but they really focus on, you know, how can they get their ingredients as close to home as possible, at the highest quality possible, as organic as possible. And Made with Local just launched, here, ironically, a protein cookie, but it's a cookie nonetheless. And it is a cookie that, you know, is it going to compete with Oreo? No, it's not. But it's a cookie that I think as people start to, and I'm only just starting, it just launched like a couple of weeks ago. So what is a small brand that's going to launch a, you know, a functional benefit cookie? How are they going to take market share? How are they going to impact the market in a positive way? I think given that they've already leaned into the market very heavily with their oat bars, their snack bars, and that they've got consumers across the country that already know them and love them, their innovation to a new product line, one where consumers already trust them, therefore they are willing to try. And just the fact that it's a cookie, though again, it's a very different kind of cookie, just the fact that it is a cookie, I think consumers, as that trust gets tapped on more and more, I think consumers are looking for brands to really bring them something remarkable. And whereas it used to be a calorie game, like, oh, I got to make sure we have, you know, enough calories, and I got to fill my cupboards and my fridge with, you know, enough calories, I think now consumers are saying, I want to fill it with the right kind of calories. I want to fill it with the right types of nutrients and vitamins and the things that our bodies need. And maybe I don't need three of this, but I only need one of that. And they can start to make really smart choices. So do I think the 300 cookie alternatives to Oreo can make a dent? Probably not. Probably one, two, or three of them need to rise up and be sort of the Olipop of that category and really command the attention. But it will be from that list of 300, those one or two or three, you know, standout brands will come. So that's where it comes to investment, whether it's venture capital or equity investment or other, you know, government programs or whatever it is, when we can see money come into the brands that are really ready and primed to make a dent, I think those are exciting. You mentioned one of the brands that we've invested in is Humble Potato Chips. And they're a really interesting scenario. A, they're a beautiful potato chip. They have four or five flavors. They're all amazing. They're a thin baked potato chip made with 100% organic potatoes. They're the only organic potato chip in the aisle. Actually, maybe there's one more now in the US, but so it's very rare to find fully organic potato chips. When they came to market with a compostable bag. Now, if you've ever, you know, gone to the chip aisle and thought, you know what I'm looking for? I'm looking for a compostable bag. Consumers would never say that. That's an added benefit to say, oh, these taste good. And all the things, all the considerations that a consumer has around why they love potato chips, usually it's taste and flavor and texture and a bunch of other things. When they got down to the compostable bag, the consumers with some loyalty thought, okay, this is cool. This connects with my values. I'm interested. Well, as you can imagine, a compostable chip bag turns out is really difficult to make. So the innovation was really, really high. And the performance was unfortunately a lot lower than anyone would have wanted. So there was a lot of product spoilage and it was a very difficult play to do. So after, I don't know how long it was, but you know, after a few years, and it was a change earlier this year, I believe Humble made, they had to go back to a more normal chip bag so that their chips would survive distribution and survive on shelf. However, they didn't just back off their sustainability initiative. They started focusing on plastic neutrality and really leaning into some of the hard places around plastic to say, in order for us to deliver organic potato chips and take a bite out of the market share of those chip brands that aren't organic, we need to still lean into how we're going to get plastic out of the system and be responsible as food makers. So, you know, innovation plays a really significant role. Just as long as there's a gap that's being met.
When people come to ethical food groups, you talk about brands, and you also mentioned, I think on a recent podcast, just around like younger consumers are becoming incredibly loyal to brands that they trust that are sustainable and ethical. What are the big differentiators, and I guess why do companies come to ethical food group? I guess there's two sides, one being kind of for venture and on the service side, on the agency side.
Yeah, you know, a lot of emerging food brands, they've gotten to the point where they are because they've been highly collaborative. They've worked with a whole bunch of different people. They've sort of slapped teams together and worked with contractors and freelancers and small teams and had part-time hires. When they come to us, they are looking for deep thinking. They're looking for good strategic thinking, and a little bit like some people refer to us as the Deloitte of sustainable food. I'm not sure everyone gets excited about working with a Deloitte given that they just sound expensive. If you've ever hired Deloitte, you know how expensive that can get. But the idea being is that, yeah, we can bring in creative. We can bring in brand strategy and marketing and D2C and websites and media buys. And we do all those things as responsibly and sustainably as we can. We focus on, you know, buying media in the most ethical way possible. We, our very own website, we have a carbon calculator on our website to just do every little thing that we can to be as responsible as we can for the planet. But when brands come to us, it's because they typically don't need just one thing. They need a bunch of things, including relationships into grocery or into brokering or distribution, or they're looking for exporting. And so they have to deeply consider a new audience or a new consumer set that, you know, they may not understand very well. There's usually a wider array of things that they need to tackle all at once. And they don't want to be an air traffic controller and kind of try to navigate again all of these things on their own. They're looking for a bit of a one-stop shop so that they can get the good strategic thinking along with the development and execution and the tracking and analytics and all that mojo that they need, especially not only to make more money, but to make investors happy. So we are an agency and consulting environment that kind of helps fill a bunch of those gaps for them.
Yeah, I think your example of Deloitte is, if you've used them before, kind of makes sense around like you guys bring that expertise because you're so focused on this space. And, you know, I'm sure your entrepreneurs are wildly different, some of them being great at the science and others being great at maybe some of the certain type of marketing or others kind of sales. But to build that team and know how to do it, obviously that makes a lot of sense. And so one of the things that I find interesting, which is that you've interviewed quite a few founders and obviously, you work with a lot of founders that are in this space, but what makes them do these type of things and take on a little bit more of these challenges comparatively to some of the other brands?
They're highly principled. Like the values that they have, they will go to their grave with them. They are not easily pushed off something. They're not following a trend of what's cool and what's hip and what's, you know, happening on TikTok when it comes to taking care of whether it's water, you know, healthy, clean water, whether it's living wages for workers, whether it's something in the community or something in the soil or whatever it is that they're really passionate about. They think about it. They sweat blood, sweat, and tears for the causes and the issues that are important to them. And so this highly principled environment means that they make very hard decisions all the time, decisions that impact their margins and their bottom line. And there are very few entrepreneurs that are truly built like that. And so being exposed to all these unbelievable entrepreneurs, this is their livelihood. This is their soul, literally putting it on the line. I have so much respect for them. I really honestly do. So the common thread might be their principles, but it's also the people around them. And I might include myself in that group where I'm just so bloody impressed because I know how hard it is. The food system is extremely hard to get into and to make money at. And so most of them don't have rose-colored glasses on. Most of them have a pretty good idea how hard it is. And it has gotten even harder these last 3 years, especially with inflation and the economy. But knowing that across the board, that's why so many of them, when they get together at their industry, you know, events or trade shows or whatever it is, and you can see, you know, these entrepreneurs clustering together in the corner, you know, they believe, they have a sense of belonging that is feels like legacy building. And that's a beautiful thing to watch. And yeah, I'm reminded of it constantly.
Well, that's amazing to hear because on my end, when somebody asks me about the people that I interview, I say I've never met a group of people that feel like nonprofits in mission and then also, you know, understand the business side and they use that business to drive that mission. But they have this just incredible passion for what they're doing and how they do it. It's funny because obviously our answers really overlap on that. And I figured they would because of the people that you get to work with. So when you think about 3 to 5 years, like what's the plan for Ethical Food Group?
That's a great question. A year and a half in, I can tell you that the future for groups like, you know, Ethical Food Group is that we all have to pull together. We all have to be extremely collaborative, and we all have to play our part in a way where we're all willing to do, you know, the hard work. So for us, yeah, part of that is the VC side, where whether it's through a VC fund or it's in other models. And one of the examples is if we do like consulting agency work for a brand, and let's just say it's a $100,000 investment in agency fees. If the conditions are right, we're able to take a portion of that in equity instead of, you know, all cash. Very few agencies are willing to do that, actually almost none, and certainly not on the consulting side either. So it means that we have an ecosystem that can be very collaborative, and we can put skin in the game. You know, a business gets evaluated carefully, and we don't take equity in brands we don't feel like they're not well managed, or if they have, you know, they're not quite ready for it. So it doesn't always fit. But when it does, it's a really beautiful thing, because these brands need to spend money and do the right thing and get the word out there and position themselves well and kind of take care of that marketing work and some of the business work really well. But when you get a chance to partner with an outfit that really cares and is going to put their money where their mouth is, I think that's a really special thing. So when I look ahead down the road, I don't know about 5 years. 5 years sounds really far for me right now, living the day-to-day jam. But, you know, 3 years from now, I would love to see Ethical Food Group as sort of like the backers and sort of the machine behind a very large suite of portfolio of food companies throughout the grocery store that are really making an unbelievable impact at the category level where they're driving trial, they're driving velocity, not through a lot of marketing spin necessarily. Obviously, the marketing plays, but where the product is just the product market fit is perfect and the packaging on shelf is doing its job, and that the consumers are not only excited, but there's something that they're proud of and that they talk about. I get really excited about that. So one of our brands that we've invested in, done a lot of work for, is called Heal. It's a plant-based meal replacement. And the idea that instead of, you know, feeding sick people, the sickest of foods, like the Boost and Ensures, what if a meal replacement actually energized and made your gut feel better and, you know, healed the body instead of made it sicker? I want to see brands like Heal just go to the moon. And it's going to, you know, not be just because this one brand has done well. It's because all of the brands around it that we're involved in are sort of all pulling towards the same goal together. So I get excited about a family of brands and companies and producers that are all going the extra mile, that, you know, we can get our team involved. And, you know, having 170 staff all get excited about a brand, it moves the needle. Just that many people alone, our shared network, just from the human analog perspective, can be really a beautiful thing. So I get excited about that.
That's incredible to hear. And it's funny you mentioned Heal. I was just reading something about that, and I just was like, this makes complete sense. You're at the hospital and you know, they hand you a Boost or something like that, and it's kind of just filled with junk. And you're like, oh, I thought this was supposed to be like something that you want to give somebody as part of their healing process. This is something that's supposed to be good to their body. So yeah, these are kind of the cool innovations that, you know, we need. And so thank you so much for joining us. Where can listeners find out more about you and Ethical Food Group?
Yes, straight up ethicalfoodgroup.com. It's pretty easy to remember. And over on podcast, it's Aisle 42 is the podcast. We're 39 episodes in right now, talking with founders and people in sustainable food space. And it's a fun chat. And coming up season two, we've got a whole bunch of other stuff planned of the podcast. So yeah, that's where we are.
Awesome. Corwin, thanks so much for joining us and for everything that you're doing in this space and amplifying everybody's story as well.
Marco, thank you. Thanks for everything you're doing.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it. And also, don't forget, subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. Corwin, that was a lot of fun. You said on a recent podcast that younger consumers are really becoming very loyal to brands that they just need to trust that they're sustainable and ethical. But what do you think this indicates for the future of purpose-driven brands, specifically in the food sector and kind of beyond as well?
Yeah, consumers have considerations in every category. And, you know, they're not all the same, but in a lot of cases, it's things like taste, performance, well, price, as we all know, and a few others. And sustainability or value-based claims typically are a little lower down. On average, we'll call it, you know, somewhere between level 6 all the way down to like, number 30. But younger consumers, you know, they're the ones as they're kind of going up through high school and college and sort of early, you know, adult life. They're spending their money on things that they believe in. And so that consideration for them in many categories is going up. It might not be number one or number two, but it might be number three or four. And so that shift of a consumer attaching their values to the products they buy, let's be honest, a big piece of that is ego. They want to be perceived by their social circle that, you know, they are buying something, you know, that's more notable and that's more good for the environment or good for people. It's got some cause behind it. The other side of that is they also want to be perceived as buying something premium, right? They want to be looked at as people that buy high quality things. I mean, we certainly see that in clothing and vehicles and other areas, but now we're starting to see that shift happen in the food space. However, I made that sound very surface, but the reality is that enough consumers that are coming into that place where they're providing for themselves, they're spending their own money, they realize that when they buy food that has ingredients in it that's bad for them, they very quickly now, they've heard the science. They know a lot of the issues that things like palm oil or, you know, soy oil or, you know, inflammatory ingredients that cause problems or the things that, you know, translate into cancer producing medical events or whatever you want to call it. They've heard these things and they've heard them so much so early on in their life that they don't have any other framework. Whereas those of us that are older, and I think about, you know, us and maybe our parents, where they're sort of like, they remember the good old days where nothing like that was ever spoke of. So, you know, their belief in it is like, oh, it's, I'll go back to my Oreo thing. Maybe I'll just eat a box of Oreos. No big deal. So they have this sort of opposing mentality around it. Younger consumers do not have that opposition. They don't have that little devil on their shoulder that tells them that the decadence and the luxury of sort of the high sugar or the high whatever would be, that it's okay, that they don't hear that as much. They really just hear that voice in their head that says, A, I want to eat something that's healthier for me, and B, I want people around me to notice it. So I know that sounds very evil and markety of me, but the reality is that consumers, as they start to consider brands that are doing better things, it's tapping into a whole bunch of different areas of their psyche and of their social constructs. So it's getting pretty interesting. And then the extra layer there is that trustworthiness that when brands, you know, say things, they have claims on the front of their package, consumers are more skeptical now. So now you see a lot of people shopping with their phones. They're using the Yucca app. They're using different technologies or they're looking something up online. I see a lot of people shopping with their phones out and taking pictures and looking at things later. And so trust and transparency are going to just continue to play their role. So it's going to be really interesting to see how far that goes.
Thanks so much for tuning into the episode of Someone Like You. We hope you found our discussions today really insightful. Next week, we'll dive into another entrepreneur founder building a business in climate. So stay tuned. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. It really, really helps us out. Follow us on LinkedIn, where we also post really great videos from this episode. Thanks again for listening, and we will catch you on the next episode.